Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday evening, October 20th, 2010. It is now 7:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620 or send us your email to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Let me repeat that the telephone number, 646-652-4620. This evening, by the way, folks, you can now listen to Liberty Talk Radio via iTunes. And lastly, I would like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Good evening, everyone. Let's see if we have everything here lined up properly. And I think we are a go. Folks, this evening we have with us as our guest, Andy Sutton. He's the chief strategist and he's an economist with Sutton & Associates in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This evening, Andy will discuss with us what is going on economically. We all hear a tremendous amount of news out there as to what really is going on or what is going on, but it's so confusing. I know I cannot watch programs such as CNBC News, even Fox Financial News, because there seems to be so much noise, and you want to get past the noise and say, what is really going on? Hopefully this is Andy on the line now, and let's see if we can get him going. Andy, is that you?
Joe, how are you?
Oh, Andy, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Well, I'm here.
Okay, great. Andy, you sound a little low. What I'm going to do is I'm going to change a few things just a little bit. And let's see if this helps out a little bit. Okay. Now, Andy, would you please speak to me?
Well, it's been an interesting month, hasn't it?
Yes, it certainly has. Andy, you still sound a little muffled. Are you speaking directly into your telephone?
Yes, I am. You want me to try and call you back?
Yeah, why don't you do that, because you sound very low. Now, it may be on my end, and if you're still low, I'll have to make some adjustments on my end, okay?
All right, I'll call you right back.
All right, thank you. Folks, I'm sorry for that. Looks like we may have had a bad connection, and let's see if we can get Andy back on the line, and this time with a little better connection. We did make some changes because we have been told that the people calling in sounded a lot lower than my voice. So we changed the mixer settings and to see how that would work out. And that's about all we did. Let's see how we fare out now. Andy, is that you?
Are we any better this time?
Yes, you're a little bit better. You certainly are. Okay, and I may still fidget with some of these dials here. What had happened in the past is that my voice was coming out very loud, and the guest voice was coming out low, so we made some changes to our dials here. And, of course, me being ignorant of all these electronics, it's not me who should be here doing this stuff, you know, so I hope I don't destroy it altogether. Well, how are you, Andy?
I'm doing well. Sounds like you should get a producer there or something.
You know, I often wish I was like Rush Limbaugh, someone like that, where he just sits down and talks, and they have, you know, one guy in charge of this, one guy in charge of that, and everything has got to be perfect, though. They don't get on the air, and everyone's job is on the line, you know, where when I sit down, I sort of, you know, say a Hail Mary and hope everything works, you know. So, well, Andy, it's been another month since we had you on the show. It seems like it was only a week or two ago. Time must be flying by. I'm not certain if we're having any fun. Are we?
I haven't been having much fun. I mean, there's been certainly a roller coaster going on, and there's a lot of talk about quantitative easing and deflation and hyperinflation and gold and silver and oil and all these good things going on. But really, the song kind of remains the same when you really think about it.
Yeah. Where do you see us going with the quantitative easing? Not the quantitative, I'm sorry, with our with each country trying to reduce the value of their currency so their exports would be more attractive to other people, thus increasing their manufacturing situation?
Well, you've got a situation here. Obviously, the dollar has been really hit hard over the past couple of weeks, and the Bank of Japan was one that decided to step right in and try to support the dollar. And it's kind of funny, you know, you're thinking about this, all right, this is a competition. You know, you would think that people would want their currencies to be strong, but no, everybody wants to be, you know, supporting the dollar just because, you know, they want to be able to keep the game going. And I think a lot of these guys understand that the dollar is kind of like the keystone, if you will, in this financial paradigm as it exists right now. And if the dollar, you know, would go away quickly, you know, you'd have a fast end to the paradigm. And I don't think that's what anybody wants. The Chinese certainly don't want it. The Japanese certainly don't want it. The Europeans certainly don't want it. But at the same time, you know, people that are looking for, you know, flight to risk or flight to quality or any of those types of things, they're not going to go towards the dollar because they understand the fundamentals behind the dollar. So it's really like a double-edged sword. You know, the Japanese can stand in and they can try and bolster the dollar and support it, but in the long run, that's not really going to end up working too well. And they're going to only damage their own situation by trying to do this. It's kind of like, you know, hey, you know, the Titanic is sinking, so I'm going to jump on there with my bucket and try and help bail it out when you know it's going to end up sinking anyway.
Yeah.
It's a bad analogy, but it probably works.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I don't understand is that I've read some articles that indicated that the U.S. Federal Reserve note is not deserving of its AAA rating, that it should be AA or single A rating or something, whatever it is, something other than the AAA rating. If these people are even near right, why does everyone still sort of pretend as if it's had a AAA rating and still buy into it? Why would anyone bother?
Well, again, I think it's the paradigm, and people want to keep the paradigm moving forward, and that's all they know how to do. When you think about it, they know how to buy bonds, and people are still stuck in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. I mean, pick your decade. You know, there's a lot of people that still think that there's bond vigilantes that are going to come out and drive yields up to 20%, and you know, that's only going to happen if, you know, the Fed decides, hey, we're not going to buy all these bonds. You know, really, in theory, they have a printing press, and they could buy every single bond
right. That
was issued by the U.S. Treasury if they wanted to. They could buy every single existing mortgage bond. They could buy every single, you know, student loan, every car loan, whatever. They could buy it all, in theory. Now, obviously, if they do that, there's going to be other consequences. So what their job really is right now is to preserve the system, is to preserve the banking system. And I think it's hilarious that we saw that the New York Fed is suing Bank of America over this foreclosure nonsense. It's like, wait a second. It's like, you know, it's like dad suing mom, you know, because the dinner was cold. You know, it's ridiculous. They're not only in bed together. I mean, they are the bed.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, it's stuff like that. It makes you makes your head kind of spin around and do a 360 every once in a while.
Well, it seems like it's a game The Trans Forecaster, for example, Gerald Celente, is very, very critical of what is going on right now. And he said we keep, and not only him, but several other economists say that we keep on kicking the can down the road. We really haven't had a financial collapse. We call it a financial collapse or whatever you want to call it. They say it's still yet to come. What is your opinion of that?
Well, I agree with him. I think he's absolutely right. I mean, he's looking at long-term trends. I mean, a lot of people are very swayed by, you know, today's news or tomorrow's news and all of that sort of thing. You know, I think what Gerald does really well, and there's others that do it too. I mean, that's what I try to do. I try to look at, all right, well, what's longer term? What's going to be sustainable? What's not going to be sustainable? Where are these trends likely to go? I mean, you have to understand what's happened in the past, because I think the one constant through a lot of what goes on economically, financially, politically, it's really based on human nature. And that's one thing that, you know, a lot of times does not change very much. And people are basically the same as they were 500 years ago. They're good in certain ways, and they have a tendency to be bad in others, and that doesn't really change too much over time. And it's nice to have a constant like that, even if it means that we're going to be in for some bad things because of it. At least it's nice to at least have one constant in the whole equation, because there's so many variables out there. And I think Gerald's right. The banking system as it exists today is going to be a lot different in 5 years if it exists at all. And in 10 years, if it still exists, it'll be totally different than it is 5 years from now. It's going towards change. This has been a long cycle, and it's been really a cycle that's lasted since the creation of the Federal Reserve. So it's longer than any of our lifetimes, unless there's somebody who's really old that's listening to this show. So this is something that's been in place pretty much our entire lives, several generations, and it's changing. And I think a lot of people are really having a hard time embracing that, hey, you know, this is a debt cycle, and debt cycles end, and it will go back to the way it was before we had the debt cycle. So I think that, you know, he's really on the cutting edge of a lot of what's going on right now with regards to that.
Well, do you think some of this has to do with the general mentality of the person, you know, the citizen of the United States, is that very few people here have ever experienced a significant, a substantial, a critical financial downturn. I mean, we've had recessions and short-lived recessions. Some people have been out of jobs, got jobs afterwards, and everything boomed after that. Do you think our mentality is such that we can't imagine, we can't, you know, we can't appreciate what really is going on because it never happened before, and since it never happened, well, it will never happen because we've never experienced it before. It's not that we've came out of a depression and now it looks like we're going back into one. We've never been into, we've had nothing but general prosperity. You think there's any logic to that?
Well, you know, it all depends on how you look at prosperity. I mean, really, if you take the family of the 1950s or the 1960s and compare it with the family today, I've got a hard time saying that there's a lot of prosperity. I mean, yes, we have more things than we had then. You know, we've got two cars, and you know, we've got nicer houses and central air and iPods and all of this kind of stuff. But there's been a consequence as well. Most people are in debt up to their eyeballs. And right. I've got a really hard time calling that prosperity, although I will admit, Joe, that I'm probably one of the few that will admit that that's probably, you know, in the minority to say something like that, because I think a lot of people have been, really, it's happened over the, you know, 30, 25 years for sure. People have really come to be desensitized towards being in debt. I mean, you take the family of the 50s, nobody ever wanted to be in debt.
Right.
And today, people just, you know, it's kind of changing a little bit. But really, people still don't understand the downside of being in debt.
Right. You think, Andy, it's such that since we've never truly experienced a deep, deep, dark depression, that we can't envision that, thus it will never happen and everything will be fine. I guess that's my point.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of, you know, mainstream outlets that are pushing that, you know, we can get around this, and, you know, they're trying to push this idea that, well, there's growth, and, you know, well, look, corporate profits are doing very well, and, well, you know, then they don't mention that most of these corporations are now keeping two sets of books. You know, I don't see how we escape, you know, the negative consequences. I mean, it hasn't been done before, and I think this idea that, well, we have computers now, and we have really smart guys like Timmy Geithner and Ben Bernanke and some of these other people, and they're going to save us from what we really deserve. I just don't see it happening.
Okay. Well, I also heard a conversation that there was a head of CEO of one of the major tech companies. I just don't recall which one it was. And he said, don't worry, technology will save the day. And he never explained how, but he thought that all the new products and the innovations coming out will eventually spur the economy and we'll be on to the roads to riches once again. Have you heard anything along those lines?
Yes, I've heard a lot of that. I mean, I must tell you that the conversations that I've been having with clients and prospective clients and those types of things lately, people seem to be shedding that belief quickly. You know, and this is a Main Street view, so I give it a lot of credibility, and there has been a shift. You know, I think if you go back to 2008, the market crashed, people didn't understand it, and they were thinking, okay, you know, this is just a bump in the road. It's like 1987,
right.
It's like 1998, whatever the case may be. This is just, you know, because they equate the markets, Joe, with the economy, and this is just a little bump in the road. And then it started to become bigger, and then the bailouts came, and I think now finally people are looking at it and saying, hey, you know, we spent all this money, we borrowed all this money. We put our grandkids in the debt. We put our great grandkids in the debt, and it's really not getting any better.
Right.
There's no jobs, not high quality jobs. Manufacturing still going overseas. That's not changing. They're looking at this, and you're having a hard time convincing people that things are great and things are well when they're not seeing it. You know, they're seeing a stack of bills, and they're seeing you know, a harder and harder time paying for it. And you know, one thing that I like to point at is the fact that you look every month, the number of people on food stamps in this country just keeps going higher and higher and higher. And yeah, I know there's abuse of that system, but I know a lot of those people are in dire straits, and you just look at something like that, and that's the most basic of needs is food. And when you look at a statistic like that, and you see that, I guess it's like 20 months now in a row, it's been going higher and higher, That just belies a lot of what we're hearing in the press and from our leaders and people like that.
Well, I know that I'm a vegetarian now primarily, and in fact I'm a vegan, if you want to call me that. And my wife now is trying to convert us over to mostly raw foods, which could be really good if you know how to fix it and stuff like that. We went to raw food classes. But you find when you do shop for nutritious, healthful foods, it is very, very expensive. It gets cheaper maybe if you go to McDonald's for a hamburger, but if you want to eat where you're nourishing your body properly, as we did many years ago, it is very expensive. And the increase in those items, the price of those items, has gone up substantially, 25% to 35% in the past year.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you take a look at the money that McDonald's has been able to make and their profits that they've been able to make over the past couple of years. I mean, you know, you take a family that would normally go out and go to, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to just give restaurant names because some of these are regional, but like a TGI Fridays or, you know, one of those kind of places where you're going to pay $50 or $60 for a family of four to go out to eat on a Friday night. Instead of doing that so much, people seem to be going to Burger King or McDonald's or fast food joints. And, you know, these guys are making a tremendous amount of money, and it's not even that cheap anymore.
Right.
You know, you go back to the 1990s, even early 2000s, you could get a value meal for about $3. Now the cheapest one's about double that. So, I mean, there's, you know, even that isn't cheap anymore. But I think you're seeing a rotation from, these more expensive places into those kind of places, and you hit the nail on the head, because we try to buy good stuff here, and it is really expensive.
Right.
You know, you go into an organic food store or, you know, anything like that, or you want good fresh vegetables, and you go into a store and try to buy that stuff, or, you know, good solid vitamins or anything like that, you're going to pay through the nose for it.
Yeah. And you know, decades ago, all the food was organic, basically, and everyone ate that way. Everyone was not as heavy as they are today. Unfortunately, it seems like America is gaining weight, it seems. And people were not as ill. I mean, they didn't have the medical, you know, technology that we have today to solve some of the problems. But for the most part, people weren't ill. They didn't have the diabetes epidemic and the autism epidemic that we have. All these other things that seem to be coming on. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of what we put into our bodies. Is that just conspiracy stuff, Andy, or is there some credence behind that?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of credence behind that. I think more and more people are realizing that too. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in that area, but I think it's common sense. You take a look at a lot of the processed foods, and you know, you start reading the ingredients, and you get to these words that are 10 syllables, and you can't even pronounce them after trying for a half hour, and it almost seems like that can't be good for you. You know, it'd be better to just eat, you know, some carrots out of a garden or something like that. I mean, I think really, you know, at the end of the day, it comes back to common sense. And you know, people are seeing that, and it's harder because, you know, that's, again, food's a basic need, and it's very expensive to eat properly. And this is, I think, you know, the advent of this real reliance on junk food and obesity and that kind of thing, there's a lot of reasons behind that, but I think one of them is the fact that we've kind of gone downhill in terms of this prosperity, you know, where it's sort of like a pseudo-prosperity, where, yeah, we can eat out, but we have to eat garbage
right.
to be able to say we're eating out. You know, it's one of those kind of things. So I think that does play into that a little bit, you know, maybe more than a lot of people would really consider, but I think that's a component of it anyway.
Yeah. Folks, this is I'm Joe Cristiano. You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. We are pleased to have us with this evening Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton & Associates and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We are discussing economic issues, and please give us a call, 646-652-4620, with any comments or questions that you might have. We welcome all the calls this evening. Andy, maybe you could help explain how this is done for our listeners. You know, we hear that the Japanese are propping up the dollar, for example, or one country is propping up the currency of another, or one country is making their currency cheaper against other currencies. How, in fact, do they do that? I mean, what process do they go through? What happens?
Well, there's a bunch of different ways they can do it. I mean, they can go out and they can buy treasuries, and that'll stimulate demand for the dollar. They can go right into the foreign exchange markets and buy dollars. They can do what are called swaps. The U.S. has done them with no less notably Europe. Those are generally not very well publicized, but what they'll do is they'll swap yen for U.S. dollars, and that's usually done in coordination with the Federal Reserve or a large bank or something along those lines. The most effective weapon is they can talk, and these markets are still really affected by talking. And this is one of the things I think people really need to pay attention to, particularly right now, is talking. And there's a lot of jibber jabber and rhetoric about the Federal Reserve buying anything that moves. And one of their governors, I forget which one, I think it was Dennis Lockhart, was just on saying, well, we might buy $100 billion worth of bonds a month. And I'm thinking, all right, that's $1.25 trillion a year roughly into the pockets of the banks,
right,
which they'll promptly sit on, and by and large, and not really lend to the general public and small business, just like they've been doing with the last several trillion that they got. How is that going to benefit anybody but the large banks?
Right.
So this is talk, though. They haven't actually done it publicly. They've been doing it privately, but not publicly. So, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric, and the Japanese can do the same thing, and the Chinese can do the same thing. You know, you get, you know, a central bank official or finance minister or somebody in that type of a role starts talking about doing this or doing that, and they can move markets just with words. And a lot of times the words are, you know, talk is cheap, And the words are oftentimes a lot easier than actually enacting real policy, just because they can talk, and then the next time they can talk again, and the time after that, well, then they might have to do something. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They can kind of kick the can down the road a lot by just talking.
Yeah. Well, who was the person or the group or the organization that you have most faith in as far as what's going on, and who do you follow, for example? So maybe our listeners can not only follow your advice through your paid subscription service and as well as your free service, but others as well.
There's a bunch of different places people can go to check out information. You know, one place where you can go to get a decent, accurate government statistics is John Williams. He's over at Shadow Stats. He's got a good place. He's got some free information there that people can look at, information on money supply and stuff like that. He's got a good macro view there as far as, you know, just looking at things from a purely statistical standpoint. And you already mentioned somebody, Gerald Celente.
Yeah.
I mean, he does a lot of audio interviews. People can listen to him as far as hearing what the trends, you know, happen to be going forward. He's really good. And I listen to, when Gerald talks, I listen just because he makes a lot of sense. And I think he uses sound logic. And I think the logic is really a lot of what's lacking in a lot of the analysis that goes on today. So, yeah, I think people, what they need to do is they need to, you know, listen with a very discerning ear and you know, put it to the sanity test, really, for themselves. All right, does this make sense? You know, if it makes sense, okay, well, then maybe listen a little bit more, read a little bit more, or whatever. And if somebody's telling you something that just doesn't make any sense, then you've got to take that at face value, too.
Well, you know, the problem that I'm having recently is that it seems that those that make the most sense are those, and I'll use this expression, who are on the dark side. Those people who are saying, really, watch out below, and then they give, you know, a dozen reasons or three good reasons why, and you say, they're correct. But, you know, like anything else, you can give three perfectly good reasons, but there's three others in the background. Those that are more optimistic seem to just have just... they're not as concrete in their justification. Is that just because I'm cynical and I want to hear the dark side only? Or am I not alone there?
Well, you know, I think that's a good point that you're making. I remember, you know, many times, I'm going to use the education example. I remember when I was in graduate school, and one of my first econ professors, this is going to take a little while to tell the story, but I think it'll make a good point. One of my first professors was an exile from South Africa, of all places, believe it or not. She was very against apartheid, and really a lot of the required readings, it was a banking and monetary policy class. And a lot of the materials that we read were materials that challenged a lot of these paradigms that existed in the world at that time, and one of them was the Keynesian School of Economics. And she was very outspoken against the Keynesian School and really got me in particular thinking about these things. And this was one of the things I noticed going forward, to get back to your question. When you question these people and you start to really drill down and ask them why does this happen? Why is this going to work? Why do you think that you can just print money endlessly and borrow from our grandchildren and do all these things and have no negative consequences? Eventually you're going to get to the point where they don't have an answer. And when you get to the point that they don't have an answer, now you've found a broken philosophy. You found a broken argument.
Right.
You found somebody that's spreading rhetoric and not common sense. And that's what you need to keep doing. You need to keep asking why.
Right.
Why is this going to happen? Why is that going to happen? And I cannot tell you how many times I had PhD-level professors say to me, well, that's the way it is, or because I said that's the way it is. And as soon as somebody does that, you know that they're spewing stuff that you normally find in the middle of a cow pasture.
Right. We do have a caller on the line. Let's see. This looks like someone from Atlanta. Is this someone from Atlanta or someone from Montana? 770, you're on the line.
It's... Adam, Adam from Atlanta.
Adam, okay, I recognize the telephone number.
Pleased to be with you tonight.
Welcome. Thank you so much for calling. Fine, thank you. How are you, Adam?
Good. I'm well. Thank you very much.
Great.
I have a question for Mr. Sutton, if I may.
Surely.
There was an Atlanta investment advisor who hosts a radio show. He recently spoke at a luncheon event that I attended, and he talked about the need for individuals to own the same percentage in bonds as their age. So, for example, a 50-year-old should have 50% of his portfolio in bonds, 65-year-old, you know, 65%, et cetera. And I'd be eager to hear your opinion, and I'll listen to the answer off the air.
Thank you, Adam.
Well, Adam, that's a real good question, and you probably already have an idea where I'm going with that one. This is an example, in my opinion. I don't know who you're talking about or who the fellow is that said that, but I think this is an example of somebody who was stuck back in the 1990s. There was a philosophy back then, and there still is. It pervades the investment world that when you're young, you own stocks, and when you're old, you own bonds. And the idea behind owning bonds is that you're going to get income. Well, there's pretty much a problem there if you're going to rely on income. Say you have $1 million portfolio and you invested in even the longest end of the yield curve, the 30-year, and you're looking at, you know, 3-ish%, 3.5-ish%. That's roughly about $30,000 to $35,000 a year in income. I don't know a lot of people that really are going to be able to live too much of a life on that with $1 million portfolio. The problem is, this is, you know, a bond is a promise to pay down the road. And you look at the dollar, you look at what's being done to it, you look at what's being done with bonds. I mean, it's supply and demand. Yeah, sure, the Fed can buy every single bond, but the government seems to be willing to supply just as many as the Fed's willing to buy. So how does that really play into something that's going to be worthwhile for the individual? You know, in my opinion, the only thing worse than a promise of a dollar today is the promise of one tomorrow, because they seem intent on destroying it. And, you know, this deflationary period that we have going on right now aside, and Joe, don't let me go away for this hour without hitting that again, because I think it might have been Adam that asked that very good question last month, and we need to talk about that some more.
Okay.
But you've got a government that's in a $202 trillion fiscal hole. That's the net present value of the hole that they're in. It is massive. Why would anybody want to own a bond, let alone an increasing number of these bonds, as you get older and you're going to rely more and more on that bond income? That seems like patent foolishness to me.
What, could you repeat that figure again?
The $202 trillion one?
$202 trillion.
Yeah, a friend of mine, Larry Kotlikoff, up there at Boston University. I've talked to him a couple of times on my own.
Yes, I know him. Yes, in fact, I had him on my program once.
Did you have him on here?
Yes, about 2 months ago.
That's right. I remember that now. Sorry about that. You know who he is.
Yes.
He uses a life cycle, a two-period life cycle modeling, and calculates this every so often. And I'll give you points of reference. In 2006, the gap was $65.9 trillion. At the beginning of 2010, I think it was February when I talked to him, it was around $185 trillion. And a few months ago, I guess it was back in August, if I'm misquoting the month, please forgive me, but it was $202 trillion. So that's the gap.
It's incredible.
And that's assuming that we keep current policy exactly the way it is. It's a massive gap. Why would somebody want to own a bond that's issued by a government that owns $202 trillion, it's just patently insane.
Yeah.
You know, but this is what these people do.
Well, I had the same experience as Adam had. A company that I used to work for, I have a 401k with them, and they sent me a letter saying, we have a financial advising firm that we'd like for you to call. They'll give you one free hour of financial advice, and then if you are interested, you can sign up for their services, and they charge so much, you know, per quarter, and they will manage your 401k plan. So I called out of curiosity more than anything else, because I handle everything myself. And the fellow I spoke to was a real nice guy. His name was Vern, but a hell of a nice guy. But he didn't know any. I mean, from my perspective, didn't know anything. I said, Vern, where do you see us going first before we get into my portfolio? He said, well, Joe, let me tell you. He said the financial debacle that we had a couple of years ago and all that val-de-la, he said, is overstated, overdone. He said, everything is really fine. We're coming back. And he said, it was just, he says it was exaggerated. He said, there really is no problem at all. And then he went on to recommend, as Adam said, you know, so much in bonds, so much in cash and whatever. And I didn't say anything to him. I mean, I didn't disagree. We didn't have a philosophical conversation. I said, Vern, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I'll consider what you had to say. And he said, fine, Joe, thank you very much. And I said, and before I hung up, this is what I said. I said, oh, and by the way, Vern, see you on the breadlines. Click. I had to say that. I mean, I just had to be a wise guy and say that. But I did. I did exactly
well,
that.
You know, this is,
I couldn't
this
believe
is
it.
What people get. They go, you know, and I get these things all the time from advisors and through the Chamber of Commerce and that kind of stuff. And this person's giving a lunch. That person's giving a lunch. And sometimes I go, or just, you know, like a webinar or something like that. And sometimes I'll participate just to see what's being said.
Right.
I like to know what the mainstream is talking about.
Yeah.
Because I use that to kind of back test my own thinking.
Yeah.
And this is what you get. You know, a 65-year-old person will go in there and say, hey, you know, I got a portfolio here. It's, you know, whatever, $500,000, whatever the case may be. And they say, oh, well, you know, and they'll say, well, it's in stocks. Well, you need to sell all those stocks and go to bonds.
Right.
Well, what if that poor person lost 40% over the last 3 years?
Right. Yep.
So they're supposed to take a 40% loss and go into bonds so that when that whole mess falls apart, so they can lose another 40%. Yeah. I mean, that's just foolishness. But this is what you get.
Yeah. Well, this guy had a coronary because when he looked at my account, it was all in oil stocks paying a high dividend. It was all equities, not a dime in cash, not a dime in preferred or dime in bonds. And he said, "He said, how old are you?" I said, 67. I mean, the guy almost had a coronary on the telephone, you know? It was amazing. Oh, by the way, we have another caller here. Let's see what this caller has to ask or say. Caller, your area code 918. You're on the air, your first name, and where you're calling from, and your question, please. Thank you for calling Liberty Talk Radio.
Hello, Joe, Andy. This is Jim Bixby.
Oh, Jim. Hi.
How you doing, Jim?
Good, good. How are you guys tonight?
Not too bad.
Andy, to say the least, we live in interesting times, very uncertain. It's a crazy world out there, and I appreciate the straightforward, candid conversations and commentary that both of you offer and in your two cents. Your two cents emails that I receive, and Joe's been encouraging me to get on board with your paid subscription. So I probably need to do that. But that aside, I realize that you cannot offer specific investment advice to someone like me on a show like this. But I'm very confused and perplexed. I manage you know, well over $1 million dollars in several different accounts and portfolios, and I'm heavy on the theme of a debasing of the U.S. currency. So I'm heavy in hard assets, metals and mining commodities, and obviously with that you have to accept their volatility. But I'm in this, you know, I'm in this for, you know, 5, 10, 20 years, so I can stomach a fair amount of volatility. But my question is, I've got about 30% on the sidelines right now, and I hate just sitting on U.S. dollars because I know their eventual fate. But I'm really hesitant as to figure out where in the heck is a, you know, safe, solid investment long-term, other than the things that I've already mentioned, that I've the themes that I've stayed with. And so I guess what kind of just general advice, you know, I'm 52 years old, I've shared with you a little bit about my investment philosophy and my portfolio size. Do you have any just general comments or advice as to how you would direct a client or prospect in this predicament?
Well, yeah, I think probably, you know, some real general advice that I could give people is to look at time preference. And, you know, the older you get, obviously, the closer your time preference comes to the present. And, you know, I think as people get older, you need to focus more on things that are going to produce income for you in the present time and not 10 years out the road. And you get less speculative. And I think that's pretty well understood by most people. You don't want to take a lot of risk the older you get. But it's not just that. You know, I think that, you know, especially with markets being as nutty as they are, for lack of a better description, people really need to focus on things that are going to produce something for them right now. And Joe kind of mentioned what he does a little bit, and there's a lot of validity to that. And just because he's getting something tangible out of it, and it happens on a monthly or a quarterly basis. And he's got something he can hold in his hand, and he can do whatever he wants with it. He can buy more, he can, you know, buy a yacht, or he can do whatever he wants. I think when you get talked into doing things that, well, you know, this might take 20 years, but this is really going to be a winner. I think you have to be really, you know, wary of that kind of a thing, just because of the fact that we just look at what's happened in the last 10 years. I mean, try to predict what's going to happen 20 years from now. I think that's impossible.
Right.
A lot of people 10 years ago would not have predicted that we are where we are right now. So 20-year time horizons are difficult to manage. I think even if you're a younger person, you have to manage it in 2 to 3 year blocks at the most, and look to go into something that's going to work over a 2 or 3 year period, and then reassess. And you have to constantly reassess. And that's probably the best advice I could give anybody, really, regardless of your age.
Right, right. Thank you. Just a real quick follow-up. It was in the news today, and Joe and I have talked about it. We're intrigued by these rare earth elements, and but having a hard time finding a good place to make an investment in that. I saw that the talking heads on CNBC with the news out of China that they're going to limit exports and control, I guess currently mine, over 90% of them. There's this Moly Corp, but they're not even in production yet, and it's very, very speculative, and the stock has more than doubled in the last 6 months. So I guess it's you know, again, it's an area that intrigues me, but I can't find a real safe play in that sector. Do you have any comment on rare earth elements?
Well, you're not going to find dividend payers in that space. They just don't exist.
Right.
Those are all speculative. Everything you said, I mean, I saw the piece today on China, and we've known this for a while. I've been talking to people that are experts in that area for a couple of years now about REOs and what's going on there, and they really do have a stranglehold. And, you know, outside of China, there's a couple plays. There's a few in Australia that are, you know, set up. China tried to grab one of them. It didn't work. The Australian government said, no, thank you. That's going to be a battle that's going to have to be watched. Moly Corp obviously is a couple years away from production. That's going to be an area, and people do not understand how much we depend on that stuff. And it's not just for military. You know, they talk about military and missile guidance and all this other stuff. It's not just that. It's the magnets in these hybrid cars. It's your iPod. It's your iPhone. It's your cell phone. It's your big screen TV. I mean, these things are everywhere. And
right.
We just do not have command of sustainable supplies of these items at this point in time. And they've really got us over a barrel on this. And I think this is probably one of the top five stories of the next couple of years. It's just not being told.
I agree. It's a very tenuous situation. And as you know, wars have been fought over resources, different resources in the world over time. It's not to mention it's very questionable as to our involvement in the Middle East, if it might have something to do with some natural resources that coincidentally are underground in those countries. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Yep.
And lastly, whenever I talk about investments without getting too complicated, I always like to keep a silver American Eagle coin in my pocket. And if people ask me about investments, I say, well, it's real simple. If I had to make one investment and I just hold that coin out, and said, just start accumulating these things.
Yeah, it's a good way to make a point, really. I mean, a lot of people, they won't know what it is, and they'll look at it and they'll say, well, that's only worth a dollar, and then you get into that whole discussion. And, yeah, it's a good way to educate people.
Exactly. Yeah, it says a dollar face value, but the spot price of this the bullion weight of this coin today is worth 24. So, and like you said, from there you can go in whatever direction depending upon their interest. But again, appreciate your coming into Joe's broadcast every month, and keep up the good work. And thanks so much for your advice and comments.
Well, you're welcome.
All right, take care.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you listening in. Andy, recently I've read an awful lot about the shortages of water worldwide and the fear that the shortage of water as well as food, which has been chronic around the world since time immemorial, may cause some real political economic disruptions. Apparently, India is now buying water from us, which we're taking off of, I think, from Alaska, from some of the ice shelves there. And same thing with Russia is starting to buy water from us. Is areas like that good for the average investor to buy an ETF in water or even, let's say, uranium, which is going to come on stream? There's several nuclear power plants that are going to go on stream, you know, by the end of this year, both in China, India, and other places around the world. Are those places where people should be really looking to park their money, or they should be avoiding those places, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I think the comment there would be the same as it is with a lot of these other strategic assets. Beware nationalization. When the reality hits that we don't have enough of this, that, or the other thing, you're going to see nationalization. You know, everybody kind of blasts Venezuela and, you know, some of these other countries for doing this. But you know what? When the rubber hits the road, I think you're going to see places like Canada, places like the United States, places like China with the rare earth oxides. You know, a lot of these places are going to start really locking down strategic supplies of these things. Again, it's another paradigm shift that I don't think a lot of people are following too much and are that aware of, but it's out there. Now, that said, in the meantime, you know, those are certainly things that people can examine. Anything that's hard to get, anything you've got to dig a hole in the ground for or drill a hole
right.
for or grow in a field, you know, or consume, anything that's tangible is going to be worthwhile. We've got a growing population, and that's just the way it is. You know, there's only so much of this stuff, and I think people really take it for granted that this stuff is always going to be there in vast quantities, and that's just not true.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in the meantime, you know, there's certainly, you know, some great areas that people can get into.
Right. You know, there's the old saying, he who has the gold makes the rules, and they say now
that's
in
right.
the future they'll say he who has the water makes the rules. But, of course, wars have been fought over much less than that as well. So, you know, this could mean the concern is destabilizing the world, basically, because there'll be people with water and people who need the water, and they'll want it, and they'll get it one way. They'll have to get it one way, shape, or form. Anyway, it doesn't seem to be a very stable, pretty picture in the future.
No, it's not. You know, and again, you've got this situation where it's being exacerbated because you have governments and central banks that are kind of perpetuating the current, or trying to perpetuate the current consumption functions by, you know, all the stimulus and doing those things. You know, we need to be taking a serious look at, you know, how we consume resources. And I'm not one of these guys that, you know, is, you know, into the global warming thing. I mean, that's a political thing. I'm talking from a resource constraint perspective. You know, we've got to manage these things more carefully, and we're not doing that. We just want to get back to 2003 and 2004, where everybody can just, you know, get a new car every year, and
right.
we can just, you know, buy more houses and do all this kind of stuff.
Right.
We just want to get back to those days instead of embracing the fact that, hey, you know, the reality changed, and we need to get on board with that. We need to look at the fact that, you know, every month, you know, I do tabulations, and you've seen it in the newsletter. You know, we run a 2 million barrel per day oil deficit in
right.
this country every
right.
day.
Right.
And that's been going on for months now.
Yeah.
And it's public information, so it's not like I'm sharing the secrets of the Holy Grail or anything like that. Anybody can go on DOE's websites and find this information, but people don't do it. That's the reality.
Yeah.
We're not preparing for that. We're just trying to figure out how to get back to 2003, and it's our government, it's the people, it's the banks, you know, for a large perspective. It's just that's the paradigm, and that's why I said earlier, it's really important to consider what people like Gerald Celente say, because they're looking at these paradigms and they're trying to parlay how they're going to shift going down the road based on what are realities, and they're trying to use logical arguments and logic to solve these equations instead of just trying to go by, you know, the old rhetorical pablum.
Yeah. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. You did want me to remind you about deflation. You said you wanted to hit on that subject before you left us this evening.
Yes. You know, there was a good question that was brought up right at the end of last month's show. I can't believe it's 10 to 9 already. Anyway, the individual asked about gold, and they asked about the dollar, and they asked about deflation. And they said, how can it be that you've got gold making new highs? And that was a month ago. We've made more new highs.
Right.
When you have a contraction going on in M3, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And
okay, good
what
question.
I wanted to kind of get out there is that there's a couple of things that could potentially be driving the situation with gold right now. We do have an M3 contraction going on if our data that we can look at is at all accurate. There's a bunch of different people that do compilations of that, and they're all pretty much coming to the same conclusion, and it looks like we're running at about a 4% contraction on an annualized basis in M3. M1 and M2 are growing slightly, but not notably. So there's not this major hyperinflation going on that you would think from all this money printing that's going on because it's being sequestered at the banks. But you have expectations by many, many people that there's going to be hyperinflation because of all the money printing. And I think that could be one of the things that's driving gold. And I think a second thing is the fact that central banks aren't selling gold anymore. Now they're buying it. They're net buyers.
Right.
So instead of selling pressure in that market, now you have buying pressure, and it's harder and harder for the J.P. Morgans and the HSBCs of the world to beat gold down with their paper short game that they've been playing for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It's becoming harder and harder for them to do it, and when that one blows up, they're going to need another bailout. So you can take that one and put a stamp on it and mail it in.
Well, when the government talks about quantitative easing, and they print money and give it to the banks, take it, sit on it or invest it, you know, they don't have to do anything with it because they're getting it for free. Does that increase the M3 money supply, or is it only increased after the banks let loose of it?
Well, the banks do most of the inflation in this country through the multiplier.
Right.
So when you take a dollar and walk into a bank, they make $10 in loans.
Right.
They multiply
the
money supply. If you walk into the bank with your dollar and deposit it, and they sit on it or they park it over at the Fed, it doesn't get multiplied. So that's what you have going on right now. You've got some destruction of some money in certain areas, and there's no creation, or there's not enough creation, I should say. I mean, certainly there's loans available. Certainly people can get mortgages. It's more difficult. They're not as profligate as it was a few years ago. And frankly, to be honest with you, it shouldn't be. But I look at it this way. You take an economy and you get it hooked on credit. And there can be no argument against that. That's exactly what they did. They got the economy hooked on credit. They got it hooked on easy money. And now what they're doing is they're taking away the punch bowl, and they're saying, well, guess what? Now you're going to have to run without it.
Right.
And by the way, we want you to hire more people, and we want you to act just as you did before, but we're taking away your punch bowl.
Right.
And it's not working.
Yep.
And this is why unemployment's not getting better. And this is why you're not seeing small businesses having any confidence. And this is why consumers aren't confident and all these other types of things. So that's really what has been going on over the past year in particular. You know, the banks are sitting on this money. You know, the last time I looked, they were sitting on over $1 trillion that was sitting at the Fed that the banks just had parked there in reserves. They're sitting on it.
And I assume normally they wouldn't have that much.
Why?
Right? Normally they would not have that much, right?
They took your bailout money. They took my bailout money, and now they're sitting on it.
Well, how do they make any money just sitting?
They got made whole.
Yeah, but they don't make any money on that, though, do they, Andy? I mean, if they just sit on it, they're not going to make any money, are they?
they're making money on their. A lot of these guys are bragging about. And this is another whole soapbox you're going to throw me up on.
I'm sorry.
A lot of these guys. Everybody's making money in trading, and everybody's making money in their trading business, their investment business. You look at all the bankers. Everybody's winning. Wait a second. There's two sides of every trade.
That's
if
right,
all the
yeah.
bankers are winning and all the banks are making money on their investment portions and their trading segments of their business, who exactly is losing?
Yes, right.
There's got to be a loser
right.
in there somewhere.
Right.
I don't know who the losers are, but there's got to be a loser
That's
in
right.
there somewhere.
That's right.
So if the big six are winning, who are the losers?
Yeah.
And that's what people need to be asking. And when you start getting into these mainstream advisors and people like that, these are the kinds of things you need to ask them. You need to say, well, if you're winning, and if you know JP is winning, and Goldman is winning, and Morgan is winning, and HSBC and Citigroup, Bank of America, they're all winning. Who exactly is losing?
They'll probably tell you people not as smart as us.
Well, you know what? I don't think it has anything to do with being smart.
Right.
I think it has to do with stepping outside the conventional, you know, half-baked logic and looking at something and using a little bit of discernment and a little bit of brain power and saying, this doesn't make any sense.
Right.
If there everybody's winning and there's no losers, that well, that's not a market. You know, there's two sides to every trade.
Well,
but what exactly is going on here? There's a lot of fraud, and that's what's going on. You know, these banks are allowed to keep two sets of books. That's the answer. Nobody
okay.
knows what the losses are because there's two sets of books. If you want to know more about that, just take a look at FASB rule number 157. It allows them to mark to model. So you have all these things going on, and it's messing people up because, you know, somebody will call and they'll ask a genuine question like, well, we've got deflation, you're saying, Andy, and yes, I am saying that, but at the same time, why is gold, you know, pushing $1,400 an ounce?
Right.
Well, you've got expectations. You have central bank buyers. You have supply constraints. You have a lot of things going on that are driving that market. It's and really, what is going on is really, to be honest with you, it's really messing with the conventional logic on a lot of these.
Andy, I think we lost Andy. We lost the line. I can start singing if everyone will just hold on. We're almost through with the hour. Somehow we lost our guest. Oh, boy. Everything just went down. Let's see. Well, I hope our audience can hear me, although I have nothing, absolutely nothing to say. Let's see if Andy calls in. I guess we lost him. It's about, we have about 2 or 3 minutes to go for our, just about 2 minutes to go for our broadcast. I don't know what happened. Let's see if he calls back in again. There he is. Andy, is that you?
It is. I don't
oh, okay.
know what happened. I could hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, you were off the board altogether, and I guess there was a computer glitch or something happened somewhere, but the screen went, the incoming telephone screen went blank for a second. I'm awfully sorry about that. I don't know. I didn't touch
it's
anything.
Right.
It just went. Okay. So you can finish your thought now.
I'm not sure how far I got before it dropped me. I was just talking about what was going on with two sets of books in the bank.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the ingredients behind, you know, seeing this, you know, very high gold price and a deflationary situation. Now, granted, that could reverse. It's done it before. You know, we could see M3 growth at 5 or 10% by the time the year is over, and it did look like it put in something of a bottom a few months ago. So, you know, in respect to that argument, you know, we could certainly see that thing change. And I think there's a lot of expectations that hyperinflation is going to be the only way to go. I kind of sit still on the fence a little bit on that one just because I see what happened back in the 1930s and how they managed to basically pull a reset of the system, granted under much less strenuous of circumstances. But I don't necessarily rule out the idea of the Fed and others talking about inflation and at the same time promoting deflation, and this allowing banks to park large amounts of money at the central bank certainly makes an argument for that point.
Yeah. Well, the banks are getting the money for virtually nothing, right? Because the discount rate's zero at this point or close to it, right?
Yeah, and they got a bunch from the taxpayers, too.
Right. Okay. Well, Andy, it's an hour just absolutely flew by once again. Let me give you the last minute or two to just to say whatever you want to say to wrap things up. And tell our listeners, you know, how they can reach you and find you and get the information or whatever, okay?
Sure. I think that probably what people need to keep their eyes on, and it's been my buzzword for a while now, it's sustainability. When somebody mentions something to you, a financial trend, ask yourself, is that sustainable? You know, knowing what you know, do your homework. Is that going to be something that's sustainable? And do that particularly before you make any kind of investments whatsoever. And I think that's probably good sound general advice. If people want to talk to me, the best way to find me is either my phone number here is 888-633-5420. They can reach me that way, or they can go to my website, which is www.sutton-associates.net. That's either one of those will work, and I'll be more than happy to talk with people about specific situations.
Okay, Andy, thank you so much for being our guest this evening. I really appreciate it, and I hope you will come back about a month from now and give us an update once again.
Absolutely, Joe. I'll be looking forward to speaking to you then.
Okay, thank you, and good night, Andy.
All right. Bye now.
Boy, Andy is so interesting. He's so knowledgeable. We have to be so careful, folks. You know, this is hard times. These are very, very difficult times. And I think what we have to do is we have to dismiss all of our thoughts of what America used to be and project that into the future, because what America used to be, we cannot project in the future because it no longer is and never will be unless there's something catastrophic that happens and brings us back to where we should be. And I get really upset about that because our America no longer exists. It exists in our minds only, not in reality. And that is the saddest commentary I have ever made. Folks, this is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Shakers Audiology for their financial support. Ranch Shakers Audiology is a family hearing practice here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They support this station, and we appreciate their support. They can be reached at area code 918-749-7711. You can further the we'd like to also thank you, by the way, for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, folks, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is truly in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign at his desk that says, "Don't steal." The government hates competition. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.